The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about where small dogs come from. Well, Dave, where do small dogs come from?
Well, it's actually a very controversial topic in evolutionary biology. What scientists agree on is that all dogs seem to have originated from the gray wolf. When humans first domesticated the gray wolf, down the line, that turned into the domestic dogs that many of us share our homes with today. But there's been conflicting evidence about exactly where this happened. Some DNA evidence suggests that it happened in East Asia, probably around somewhere between 5,000 and 16,000 years ago. But there's been archaeological evidence in Europe and the Middle East suggesting that humans were domesticating dogs as long ago as 31,000 years ago. So we've got different time points and different parts of the globe.
So where did this new data come from for this study?
Well, in this new study, Rob, the researchers focused on this gene called insulin-like growth factor 1, or IGF-1. And the reason they focused on this gene is because this gene seems to be really critical for determining the size of a dog. It really determines the size of their skeleton. And so what the researchers did was they took DNA from tissue and blood from a variety of dogs, big dogs, small dogs, also from wolves, and even from coyotes. And they tried to see from the genetic data if they could get a better sense of where all dogs came from. But what they found, what the data sort of spit out, was a really interesting idea about where small dogs came from. And the reason is because they found this one variant of IGF-1 that's closely associated with small dogs. All small dogs seem to have this variant. And when they did some pretty complex genetic mathematics, what they found was that the gene seems to trace back to a dog domestication event that happened about 12,000 years ago in the Middle East. Now, this doesn't give data for all dogs, but what it does strongly suggest is that at least for small dogs, this is the time point and the place where these dogs seem to have first been domesticated.
So not East Asia.
Not East Asia, as had been a popular theory.
Well, whether East Asia or the Middle East, is there any growing consensus about why people might have selected for small dogs in the first place?
Well, people in these regions tend to live in these small agricultural communities. And if you're talking about small communities with potentially limited resources, but you still want a dog to carry out various tasks for you, you want a smaller dog because he would eat less. And so that's one idea about why small dogs came to be in the first place.
Okay. So what other stories have you got with you this week?
Well, Rob, from dogs in the Mideast to bacteria at the bottom of the ocean, this next story is about how bacteria may be forming some sort of power plant or power grid, as it were, at the ocean bottom.
What are they doing with the power?
Well, Rob, the idea is that these bacteria are somehow sending the power to each other so that they can survive. And the reason this is such an issue in the first place is there's this mystery going on at the bottom of the sea. It turns out you've got bacteria that live right on the surface of the seafloor, but there's also bacteria that are living about a centimeter below the mud, as it were. And the bacteria on the surface have a lot of oxygen because there's oxygen in the water, but the nutrients, there's not that many nutrients in this particular part of the ocean. Whereas the bacteria that are under the mud, they don't have any oxygen, but they do have access to more nutrients just because there's more nutrients in the mud. So in either scenario, these bacteria really shouldn't be surviving. One bacteria is starved for oxygen and the other one is starved for nutrients. And so in this study, the researchers said, you know, are these bacteria somehow helping each other out? You know, are they somehow exchanging oxygen and nutrients with each other? And what they did was, these were researchers at a university in Denmark, and what they literally did was they went out to the ocean right next to their university, scooped up some mud from about 20 meters down, stuck it in the beaker in the lab. And so then they had some bacteria on the top of the mud and some bacteria that were buried further down in the mud. And then they took all the oxygen out of the water. They really wanted to stress these bacteria out and see what would happen. Now, if the bacteria on the top normally were sending oxygen to the bacteria on the bottom via, you know, some sort of traditional method where maybe they were somehow chemically sending oxygen down below, the bacteria in the mud would take a relatively long time to realize that the oxygen had all of a sudden disappeared from their environment. But that's not what the researchers saw. The researchers, as soon as the researchers removed the oxygen from this beaker, all of a sudden, they saw all these chemical processes going on with the bacteria in the mud. They were doing all of these things that indicated that they were slowing their metabolism down and that they had realized almost instantaneously that the oxygen had somehow disappeared from their environment. And so if it's this traditional chemical process of, you know, bacteria on the top sending oxygen down to the bottom, that would be way too slow for these guys to realize that their oxygen pipeline had been cut off. So in this paper, it's even though it's pretty speculative, what the researchers are saying is there must be some sort of electrical connection between these bacteria on the top and these bacteria on the bottom, or these bacteria in the mud, that is allowing them to, first of all, communicate very quickly, but potentially also that this electrical connection is the way in which these bacteria are actually sharing resources. You know, when these bacteria on the bottom get oxygen, what they're doing with that oxygen is essentially converting it to energy so they can live. But if they're all hooked up to this power grid, then they can cut out the middleman with oxygen. All they'd have to do is just receive energy directly from the bacteria at the top of the mud, and they can continue surviving.
Well, for this kind of symbiotic relationship to make sense, I guess then the bacteria at the bottom would need to be sending up some sort of nutrient or something or other to the bacteria on top.
Right. You would think they would have to live up to their part of the bargain. And researchers really aren't sure exactly how that happens. But it may happen via a slower process by which these bacteria on the bottom are releasing nutrients into the mud or into the water that are slowly filtering their way up to the bacteria at the top. That may be a slow process, but the process of these bacteria at the top sending energy down to the bottom may be very quick, which is what the researchers think they're seeing here.
And there aren't any bacteria right in between in that centimeter of mud? I mean, bacteria are everywhere, right?
Well, it's a good question. And it's possible that there's this sort of continuous community of bacteria that leads right from the top of the mud to about a centimeter down. And what's interesting, the researchers say, you know, if this power grid was sort of scaled up for humans, we'd be talking about a power grid that's about 20 kilometers long. So it's the size of a small town for us, happening for bacteria on the ocean bottom.
Okay, so last I see you've got a collection of stories. Are these from the AAAS meeting?
They are, Robin. We just got back from San Diego and we posted over 24 items, including a lot of your podcasts during the meeting. A lot of really fun stories happening at the meeting. I just run down a few of my favorites. One of my favorites, and I have to say I wrote this one personally, so take it with what you will, but it's a story about dolphin intelligence. And are dolphins so smart and so socially smart that they can actually be defined as people? There was a whole session at the meeting about whether we should really be treating dolphins as people and not as animals, and all about the ethical implications and even the legal implications of doing that. And there was also a lot of other interesting stories. We had a story about using music therapy to help people who had suffered strokes and other sort of brain damage talk. It turns out if they can't talk, they can't even say what their address is, sometimes they can be taught to sing what they really want to say. There's also a story about why crime tends to cluster in neighborhoods, why there are certain crime hotspots in neighborhoods that you don't see in other neighborhoods. Researchers have used a new mathematical model to figure out why this happens, and they're hoping that the model may actually help police break up crime rings. And finally, we had a cool story about progesterone, which is a female sex hormone, using that to help prevent brain injury. There's a clinical trial ongoing that's trying to figure out if this hormone is, you know, injected into somebody right after, say, a car crash, it can prevent some of the serious brain injury that happens with a lot of these very severe accidents. And there's a whole bunch of other great stories from the meeting. You can find them all on the site.
And how about on Science's policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, we've got a story about the National Science Foundation about how they've just released an essay saying how the U.S. can be a lot more competitive than it has been in the past in terms of being a global superpower for science. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.